Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us and great to have back Erin Presley. She is the horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, where she cares for the herb, the wildflower, and the pond gardens. And we'll be talking with her, start talking about growing herbs, and we'll take your calls and questions about herbs and other gardening questions as well as we visit with her. You can join in at 800-642-1234, or you could send me an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Erin Presley, good to have you back.
Hi, Larry. It's awesome to be here today.
So let's start by talking about what's going on at the gardens at Olbrich right now.
At the gardens, there is, you know, it's just always a lovely day to visit Olbrich Gardens. We still have a lot of fall color in the outdoor gardens, yeah. Even some blooms hanging on. We have the flowers appearing on our native witch hazels, Hamamelis virginiana, in some of our, like the woodland garden, which is one of the areas that I care for. They have a beautiful little ribbony, very fragrant flower at this time of year. We have late blooming asters. So we always like to make sure we have some good blooms out there for the few pollinators that are still hanging around. Lovely fall color in the leaves on the trees. Still what's left after at least the big gale last night. That was quite the wind. And, of course, the conservatory, if it's a little chilly outside, it's a great place to go escape as the weather gets cooler. We're also celebrating the reopening of the Thai Salah.
Yeah, you mentioned that last time you said there was work going on.
Right. So over the past, really, it was just about a year, we had a team of contractors, and they were actually led by a restoration company out of Spain, because when you're working on restoration of a structure of such significance as the Thai Pavilion that's located at Olbrich, you really make sure that you have the right people that are doing the work on that building. So the roof was completely redone, including having a community signing of the tiles on the roof. So in the future, you can look up at that glistening gold roof and envision your little words of, peace and community that went up there. And all of the gold stenciling and paint and mirror tiles on the facade of the pavilion were either replaced or cleaned. And so it's really just quite magical. And
it's a striking building.
It's incredible. And now the, all of the fencing and every barriers are taken down so people can roam throughout the structure and really get up close and take a look at the magnificent work that was done.
How did things go in the Hmong garden this year?
Oh, we had just an awesome, summer full of great vegetables and lots of community activities with the Hmong garden that is located in the herb garden at Olbrich this past year. We were able to really work on developing some relationships with Hmong artists and farmers throughout Wisconsin. And so we hosted a painting demo and workshop by a Hmong author out of the Twin Cities, To Her. We had a cooking demonstration and samples of two different dishes, a cucumber salad, as well as this really significant herbal chicken soup that is consumed in the Hmong culture specifically by mothers who have just given birth. So it's kind of like a tonic and restorative for the body. So we had a local chef come in, and it was her first time doing a cooking demo, and she just knocked it out of the park. She was so fun, and we even had a little farmer's market stand. So it was a really great day of free activities. People were able to come out and linger and, really learn about elements of the Hmong culture that we're so blessed is such a big part of the cultural landscape here in Wisconsin. Yeah. So it was a really, really awesome day. That was back in August. So.
Well, that was back in August, and now here we are.
It's been a while since I've been here. Yeah.
Yeah, and coming up is the Madison Herb Fair.
Right.
Let's talk about it.
The Madison Herb Society is an annual event that happens around this time every year. Madison Herb Society hosts the Herb Fair. So it's actually happening tomorrow, which is Saturday, November 2nd, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Ulbricht Gardens. So we're on Atwood Ave on the east side of Madison. Free, open to the public, and they have an amazing array of vendors that have all sorts of awesome herbal products available. So there's bakery, there's culinary
herbs. I bought jam before.
Yes, jam, herbal honeys. There are, you know, herbs for health and healing. There's herbs for your cats. there's some pretty awesome like catnip toys and things like that there. They have a great amount of resources, question and answer table. So if you're looking to expand your herbal practice or you know what you're growing in your herb garden, lots of people to talk to there. And then every year they host a really stellar lineup of people who are also really skilled educators about herbs. So they have three speakers lined up for tomorrow as well.
And we can talk about that as we move along. I really hope my daughter is running in her last ever college cross country meet tomorrow. So I have to be there for that. And I'm hoping I can get back in time to make it at least to buy some more jam and maybe some catnip.
Yeah, there you go. It really is always a festive day. And, of course, the gardens are open as well. Tomorrow looks like it's going to be a beautiful, nice fall day, kind of sunny and crisp out there. So a great day to take a spin out through the garden or the conservatory as well.
And, of course, you're going to pay for the jams and the honeys and all that. But there's to get in, there's no cost, is there?
Or
is
there? Not at all. Completely free to attend the herb fair, and at Ulbricht, access to the outdoor gardens is always free as well.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place to be at any time of the year, including this one. Well, let's talk herbs for a bit here. What are your favorite, or what are some of your favorite herbs?
What are some of my favorite herbs? One of the things that I brought into the studio for you today to try a little bit of is, again, in conjunction with the mung garden that we had growing at Ulbricht this summer, we grew fresh ginger. And
yes,
which is always kind of, you know, people are a little shocked that that is something that's achievable here in Wisconsin. But if you sprout those rhizomes early enough in the really late winter, and then get them out there as soon as the weather starts to warm up. This was a good year for the ginger and really a lot of, you know, garden crops in general with all the rainfall. Ginger really likes a lot of moisture and high fertility. So we grew a really bang-up crop of fresh ginger out in the garden, which is always just a real joy to harvest. That's a little bit more of a, you know, specialty item.
I just took a whiff in the little bag that you sent me, and it's
amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah. another kind of something that we have been diving into at Ulbricht this year is herbs that are more kind of in the edible landscaping category. So think of some of your herbal trees and shrubs. We are planning a new planting area that's going to incorporate some of the newer cultivars of elderberry.
Mm-hmm.
And so modern breeders have been working on cultivating elderberries that have are a little bit smaller and at a good scale for a home landscape. One of the other adaptations I found really interesting on some of the new elderberry cultivars is that they actually have fruits that kind of droop and hang down as they ripen, because if you only have, you know, one or two elderberry bushes in your yard, the birds can find those elderberries pretty darn fast when they ripen. And so by actually having the fruits that kind of hang and face downward, they're harder for the birds to notice. And you have a longer window when you're able to get there and harvest them when they're ripe. So that's something I'm kind of intrigued to explore in some of the new plantings that we have planned for next year.
Yeah.
And see some of those things fill in.
So let's talk about starter plants. For those who are new to herb growing, what are some great starter plants?
I always suggest, you know, if people have a little bit of a sunny area and they want to get into growing something and have some experience growing from seed for the first time, my top pick for growing from seed is basil, because basil germinates really readily once the temperatures get warm. There's no point in putting it out too early, so wait until, you know, mid-May or even June, sure, when you're getting, you know, consistently warm days and danger of frost is past. And so those seeds, the other thing that's really nice about basil is there are so many different varieties.
Yeah.
So if you're growing from seed, you can really explore all of these different flavor profiles that are out there, and really kind of, you know, have an easy starter plant that's harvestable over a long season that germinates really readily and kind of gives you that quick sense of accomplishment and that flavor is there.
Well, and don't forget what seeds you put where, because some you're going to like better than others. Okay, now which one is this? I don't remember where.
That's all, you know, part of the experiment of gardening is having those happy accidents where you're like, oh, I forgot I planted those, you know, daffodils there in November. And, you know, you get some of those little surprises a few months down the line.
What about, let's say we've got herbs, what about cutting herbs back in, when should we cut herbs back? Let's put it that way.
Sure. Well, a lot of your more warm weather herbs, so if you think of like basil or some of the ones that are more, you know, sensitive to frost, those should have been harvested. You know, we did get a good killing frost about 2 weeks ago here. So hopefully you brought those in early enough, and maybe, you know, freezing is a great way to save a lot of herbs that have kind of more succulent stems. So I usually freeze things like basil or parsley. Parsley is very cold hardy, so that you should
you
be able
hang
to
on for a while.
Yeah, I've definitely harvested, you know, fresh parsley around Thanksgiving time. So there's no benefit to, you know, cutting that back. And actually, a lot of the herbs that are hardy out in your land. So if you think of, you know, sage or thyme, even like if you have like lavage is a large leafy herb that has a celery flavor. A lot of those are frost tolerant, and they overwinter better if you just leave them standing in your garden. And so there's not a whole lot, if it hasn't already been frosted, that you should feel like you really have to clean up at this time of year, unless you're maybe looking at bringing herbs inside, or, you know, you say you have a special rosemary or something like that that's not going to be hardy outside, and you're thinking about moving some of those in for winter survival or winter harvest.
And we'll talk about bringing some of those herbs inside in just a minute. Our guest today, Aaron Presley, horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. We've started by talking about herbs. Take other gardening questions as well as we move along. You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Glad to have you with us for Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Aaron Presley, horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. She looks cares for the herb, the wildflower, the pond gardens. Certainly can answer your gardening questions, and I hope you join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. What's going on in your garden, or how did it go this year? Love to hear from you. Well, let's go back to bringing those herbs indoors. If you want to bring some in pots, try and get them through the winter and be able to use them. Talk about that.
Yeah. So one of the things that you're definitely going to want to think about for trying to either grow herbs, you know, from a seed or from a new plant over the winter, or what I think is a lot easier is if you have an existing plant that is outside, bringing it in and kind of just extending your harvest that way. One thing that is helpful to remember is it's pretty stressful on plants to be like digging them up, potting them up, and moving them inside all at one time. So you're probably going to have better success, say, or planning for next year, if you have herbs that are growing in pots now and you just are able to move the pots in versus trying to pot up a plant that's growing in the ground. Sunlight in your interior space is really important. So think of your, you know, sunniest, hopefully south-facing window that gets good light throughout the day. You might want to consider some supplemental lighting, because even your, what you think of as your sunniest area in your home, still is pretty dark compared to the levels of light that plants enjoy outside. And another thing that can be really helpful is just, you know, sanitation. So think of when you're bringing plants inside, clean up any leaves that look like they have been chewed on by bugs or are getting kind of yellow or, you know, have been affected by any, you know, disease or anything like that over the summer, because the cleaner your plants are when you're bringing them in, the more likely you're going to have success keeping them going into the beginning of the winter months.
Yeah, lots of good tips there. Maria in Monroe, we'll go to you. Maria, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, and I hope I don't lose you. I just joined the show, and I use a lot of herbs in cooking, and I guess my question is when I buy them by the bunch, you know, I'll put them in water, and sometimes I'll just leave them in my fridge, sometimes I'll leave them on the counter, and sometimes they sprout and sometimes they don't sprout. And I guess my question is, especially I'm thinking with the basil and the cilantro and the oregano, the best way to get those guys to propagate so I could get some roots so I could actually plant them in the dirt.
Oh, the ones that you buy in the grocery store?
Yeah. Okay. Or at a nursery.
Yeah.
Or if I buy them by the bunch, I just don't always use them all right away, and I just hate throwing them out. And I was just wondering if there is a way, the best way for me to actually get those guys to survive.
Yeah.
Right. A lot of herbs that you would be buying, especially in the grocery store, as like a, you know, culinary product, are already well past of, if you're even getting a part of the plant that is rootable, is pretty well past, you know, things in the grocery store have been around for a few days, if not weeks, before they really reach you as the home user. So your window of opportunity to be able to try to root those in water is pretty limited. One thing I have heard of people having really good success with, which I think is a brilliant idea, is go to a grocery store where you can get those little living basil plants. Yeah. So you can find in the produce aisle a whole little miniature plant that is, you know, in a little pot, and then bring that home and, you know, use some leaves that you're putting in your meal initially, and then that's something that you could consider potting up and keeping on for further harvests. As far as other, I know there is, like, you know, some trends right now about people using different types of food scraps and, like, kind of re-sprouting them from the, you know, the cut basil part of your lettuce or things like that. But for a lot of herbs, I don't think you're really, when you buy a bunch at the grocery store, you're not really getting a part of the plant that's going to be able to root and grow.
So here sits Maria with this big bunch of herbs that she wants to use in some fashion. So how does she use them?
Right. So there, I would just consider looking into how you can save some of those herbs more effectively. So like I was mentioning, herbs that are kind of more succulent, like parsley or basil, are really good candidates for freezing, and you can really hold on to the freshness of that flavor. So those you're going to want to wash and then dry them thoroughly, and then layer them in like a little Ziploc bag in your freezer. Squeeze all the air out of the bag, and then you can pick off little bits later in the winter to throw into your, you know, soups or marinara sauces or whatever. Yeah. And then other herbs that already start with a little bit more of a dry texture. So if you think of like thyme or oregano, rosemary, you know, summer savory, things like that, those are going to be good candidates for drying. Look for the warmest place in your kitchen to dry herbs. Sometimes on top of the refrigerator is a really good place because the refrigerator motor gives off a little bit of extra heat. And then put them in a very thin layer on a cookie sheet or even better yet, maybe like a cooling rack for bakery where you can get circulation on both the top and bottom of the herbs. And then dry them down to where they're brittle and crumbly before storing them in an airtight container.
Yeah. Do you ever cut them up and put them in like ice cube trays with water and so forth and then?
Yeah, that can be super handy too because then you can, you know, pop them out of those ice cube trays, throw all the cubes in a Ziploc bag or something like that. And then later in the winter, if you just need an individual size portion that is, you know, easy to just grab one
cube.
Soup
or whatever.
Yep.
Throw one or two in, depending on how much soup you're making.
Yeah, that's a really great thing to do also with pesto. I usually freeze pesto every year and then put it in some of those, you know, a kind of a smaller, more usable size portion and really gives you a lot of convenience later when you're in the midst of your big cooking expedition.
Maria, there you go. Thank you so much for calling in. Appreciate your call. Miguel in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Miguel.
Hello. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so my question is, I'm trying to, because of climate change, I'm trying to transition from planning to grow herbs in a regular farm, like open field, growing in a wooded area. And I want to know if there's any process in which it makes it easier to grow in a wooded area and which herbs would be great.
Okay. All right. So you're breaking up a little bit, but I think I've got it. We've Miguel has a wooded area and is wondering if it's okay, if he can grow herbs in a wooded area, and if so, which ones might he have the most success with? So it'd be some more that would be more shade tolerant.
Oh, a more shade tolerant herb. You might want to think of some of the more kind of semi-perennial herbs. So parsley is one that can overwinter from year to year. That might be able to do a little bit better in some shade. Again, like lavage, like I was mentioning.
Lavage, for sure.
Yeah, and that is a really great herb because it also has kind of some good structure in the garden, too. It has really bold foliage and really big flower stalks, and that has celery flavor. And so you can use, but instead of using the big stalk like you would celery, you use more like chopped up sections of the leaves. From more of a, less of a culinary, but more of a general health and wellness perspective, if you have a wooded area, it might be worth a shot trying to grow some wild American ginseng. And that, I mean, that's a very specialized crop, high value, grown by a lot of, on a commercial scale, by growers up in northern Wisconsin. But the ginseng is a native woodland plant that used to exist throughout Wisconsin in forested environments, unfortunately has really been over-harvested. But it's a great herb for memory and kind of like increasing mental capacity. Really beautiful plant, very slow growing and kind of slow to establish, but able to be grown from seed in a forested environment. And you could really kind of use your wooded location to grow some things that are a little bit off the beaten path, like ginseng, that is not something that you would really be able to have access to generally.
Otherwise, where'd you get the seeds? I suppose
I believe you used to be able to order them from Sioux Ginseng Supply. That's HSU Ginseng Supply, which is a company based up in central Wisconsin. There is another, I know I'm on the email list of a outfit called Wild Grown. Mm-hmm. So I would just definitely, if you're looking into doing something like that, the other place that has a very good reputation that I get a lot of herbs, herbal products from, and is called Strictly Medicinal. Mm. And they're actually based out of further west in the United States. But they offer really good provenance for all of their seeds, because especially when you're looking at things that have more of a, you know, cultural significance or have been threatened by over-harvesting in the past, it's really important to fully investigate where you're getting your seed stock from.
Yeah. Some good ideas for you there, Miguel. I really like the ginseng one for sure. Give that a try and see what happens. And thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Carol in Marinette emailed, she's removing loads of buckthorn and the elderberry is moving in, but there's way too much elderberry. How does she control the elderberry as she fights the buckthorn?
Oh, boy. Well, I would say that, you know, elderberry is a good problem to have. One thing that's, you know, important to think of when you're doing a big invasives removal like with buckthorn is it's good to have things in there that can just kind of hold the space, and better than having just a totally blank slate that is then open for, you know, further rounds of invasion, that unless you have a really solid idea of what you're going to put into that area right away, I would just let the elderberries grow, because they're taking up, you know, space and kind of fulfilling an ecological niche at the same time, until you really have a solid plan about what you're going to be growing instead.
Yeah. But you can, at some point, you can cut them. How do you control them?
I mean, you could dig them up if you're if they're of a scale that is diggable and not too big yet. Or, you know, you could follow whatever invasive management techniques that you are using on the buckthorn, whether that was, you know, herbicide or, whatever. But beyond that, there's, I guess the other thing that you could maybe consider is if you did want to keep a couple of those elderberries around without letting them spread further, is just cut the berries off before the birds can get at them. So this is the opportunity for you to do some harvest and maybe make yourself a, you know, a elderberry syrup or something like that, and then prevent the birds from getting those seeds and further dispersing them.
Spreading them all over the place.
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you so much for that question, Carol. Raymond in Stevens Point is on the phone. Let's go to Raymond. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, a couple weeks ago I bought some pawpaws at the Stevens Point Farmers Market that were grown locally. My question is whether if I take those pawpaw seeds and plant them, can they grow on their own in the wild?
Oh, this is going after a topic just super near and dear to my heart, the pawpaws. So pawpaw does germinate really readily from seed. So if you have a pawpaw tree, for those of you who are not familiar, the pawpaw is a fruit-bearing small-scale tree that's actually native to most of the eastern United States. The trees get to be about 25 feet tall. Eventually, when they get older, they also start to sucker. So they create kind of like more of a small grove or colony. And they're also shade adapted. So they're a really unique fruit to include in like edible landscape, and even actually tolerate more shade than a lot of other fruiting, you know, trees that you might think of, like, you know, apples or pears or whatever. And the pawpaw itself, the fruit is actually the largest fruit that is native to North America.
Yeah.
So they're a really large fruit kind of about, I would consider them in size and sort of like general texture similar to a mango.
Yeah.
Then when they're ripened, they turn kind of a yellowish green, and they're very fragrant, and then they have a custardy, really soft flesh that people describe as having a flavor that's anywhere from banana to mango to pineapple. Very
tasty.
Very unusual flavor for something that we can grow here. And so, long story short, the pawpaws are also full of these big dark brown seeds. And whether you sow them yourself or if they just drop to the ground and the squirrels kind of drag them around or whatever, they germinate very easily. And there are some cultivated varieties of pawpaw on the market, but the straight species also produces, in general, a really palatable, good quality fruit as well.
So the ones you get from the, well, Raymond got his from the farmer's market, I think he said. But if you're getting it from the grocery store, a pawpaw, is it going to, and you plant the seeds, are the seeds going to be true to form to the ones you bought?
Right. So it's pretty unlikely you're going to be able to find a pawpaw in the grocery store really at all, because one of kind of the peculiarities of the fruit is they go from being not ripe to ripe pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And then they get super soft after that. So the window that they're able to be harvested in and then actually get to you as the consumer or the eater of the pawpaw is a very short time frame, which is why you're more likely to find them at something like a farmer's market. But yeah, with a lot of these tree crops that are kind of on the rise that are a little bit more unusual. So if you think of like the pawpaw, which is Latin name on the pawpaw, just for those of you who are interested in that, is Asimina triloba. They are not super far removed from their wild type kind of like ancestors. So breeding work has been done on pawpaw, but not to the level of something like an apple that people have been working on developing varieties for years and years. So the pawpaw that you got from the farmer's market is very likely to, you're going to be able to germinate those seeds and then grow a tree that produces a fruit that is probably pretty good.
And I just took a sip of the pawpaw lassi that you made for me and brought today, and it is delicious.
We had a bumper crop of pawpaws at Olbrich Gardens this summer because actually last year there was a late frost and a lot of the buds froze. So in 2023, we didn't get any fruit. And as a result of that, the trees had kind of a lot of like extra energy that they were able to store and save last year. So this year, they were able to really put all of those extra carbohydrates and extra kind of stored potential into creating just an amazing crop of pawpaws. So I did, that was about, the pawpaws generally ripen around the third week of September. And into the beginning of October, so I saved a little bit of that pulp in my freezer, and then I used it to make a like a blended kind of yogurt smoothie drink called a lassi that has some ginger and honey too. Yeah, the flavor is really incredible, and you know, people do kind of describe it with all of these things that it's similar to banana or similar to mango, but I think there's something there that you just can't put your finger on that is just, you know, very unique and just truly, it's just truly pawpaw.
Oh, this is delicious. So thank you very much. So pawpaw lassi, and it's lassi is spelled L-A-S-S-I, isn't it?
L-A-S-S-I. Yeah, and a lassi is a kind of a yogurt or a buttermilk, usually based drink that you might find in Indian as a part of Indian cuisine. And usually it has a little herbal element to like some, this particular iteration has ginger, but it might have nutmeg or some other little herbal or spice component too.
It's so good. Raymond, did we help you out on growing pawpaw?
Yes, if I plant one, how long will it take to bear fruit?
I would say you're probably looking at least 5 to 7 years. They grow, and that timeline could be shortened a little bit if you are growing your pawpaws in a full sun environment, because like I said, they are also shade tolerant. We have a few at Ulbricht that we grew from seed, and I'm thinking that they put on some of their first fruits at about the 5-year mark. The other thing that is helpful to know is the pawpaws are generally self-fruitful. So if you only have one individual, you have a decent shot at getting fruit. But actually, like a lot of fruits, cross-pollination produces a better fruit set. And so you might, in addition to your straight species pawpaw that you're growing from your farmer's market source, you might want to go and look through a catalog. There's a really good grower called Rain Tree Farms that specialize in a lot of kind of unusual edible fruits like that, and get a different variety of pawpaw, because cross-pollination typically works best when you have kind of two different strains that are flowering at the same time, and you get that, the benefit of the kind of the hybrid vigor going into your fruit set. So we have several cultivars at Ulbricht that might be worth looking for. There's Wilson. There's a really large fruited variety that's called Prolific. There's Pennsylvania Golden, and then we also have one that I think is out of North Carolina, and it just has a name and a number. It's like NC17. So when you're, considering maybe getting a partner for the one that you're going to be growing from seed, pay a little bit of attention to some of those strains that are a little bit better adapted for northern climates. We have no problem, at least in Madison, so we're in zone 6.
You're in Stevens Point, Ray.
Yeah, pay attention to look for strains that are just adapted for a more northern climate, and you'll have a better chance at getting fruits that have time to ripen in our growing season.
Raymond, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. What about you? Question, we're talking herbs, but we're taking other garden questions as well with our guest, Aaron Presley from Ulbricht Botanical Gardens. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in for Garden Talk today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Aaron Presley from Ulbricht Botanical Gardens. Great to have her with us. Just to let you know, at later on, our last segment of the show today, we are going to turn our attention to bonsai and talk about bonsai a little bit on our last segment of the show today. But right now, the number for you to join in, any question, we've zeroed in on herbs a bit, but taking other questions too, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Earlier, we were talking about ginseng and ginseng seeds, and Eve emailed to say that Johnny's Selected Seeds also sells ginseng seeds. And Eve has a small patch in her shady backyard from those seeds, and it's working out well for her.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. The ginseng is really interesting, too, because it's definitely, a lot of these herbal plants, they really have their own, I think of them as like beings that we're living alongside. And you can't really, you can only direct their actions to a certain extent, and they still have their own, their own rhythms that they follow. And ginseng is definitely one that marches to the beat of its own drum. And so I've had many attempts that did not work out well to either germinate seed or, sprout little rootlets that you can buy. And then I've also had some really magnificent, plants that really have stood the test of time. But there's no telling them what to do.
Alyssa in Sparta, we'll go to you. I think Alyssa has a question relating to lilacs, but let's go there. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, good morning. So we moved into our home in Sparta about 10 years ago, and we have these two initially beautiful lilac bushes. One was a deep purple, one was a light purple. They are now almost, you know, to the roof of our two-story home, and they're just struggling. The branches, you know, the bases are probably 2 to 3 inches thick. The bark doesn't look very healthy, kind of dried. And then we're not bearing a lot of beautiful lilacs. And then the leaves are sometimes healthy, but this year really we're not. They did produce flowers again this fall. I think they did that within the last couple of years as well. So they bore the fruit in the spring and then again in the fall. But just wondering kind of, I know we need to do something, but if we could get some specific guidance as to how to either save these or if we need to kind of start over with some fresh bushes.
Oh, I'd do some rejuvenation. I don't know about
you,
Aaron.
Yeah, you definitely have some options. And, you know, a lot of the problems that you're describing as far as the leaf foliar diseases in the summer, especially with how much rain we got earlier this summer, the lilacs really, they're susceptible to a lot of fungal diseases that get a lot worse when the weather is humid. And so a lot of the lilacs had, you know, powdery and downy mildew. A lot of them, their leaves just drop off when they get, you know, infected to a certain level. So a lot of these problems are going to be mitigated by, you got two options here. So one of them is what we would call renewal pruning or rejuvenative pruning. And what you'll be doing is looking at the base of your shrub and identifying about a third of the thickest, kind of oldest, gnarly canes, and just cut those off,
get
flush
rid of them
at
right
the
at the
soil
base.
Surface, and just get them right out of there. So what this is going to do is it opens up space for new shoots to grow up next year, promotes better air circulation throughout the plant, which can help with a lot of those fungal issues. Another thing with the lilacs is it just by getting rid of some of those, the really tall branches that are going all the way up to the top of your house, like you were mentioning, the new shoots will have flowers that are down shorter where you can actually see them and smell them versus having all the flowers, you know, 20 feet up in the air.
That every year. A third every year.
Do a third every year. The other thing that can be helpful is a lot of times with shrubs like that, multi-stem shrubs, and this is a technique that you can do on really a lot of your common landscape shrubs. If you think about many different types of viburnums, definitely dogwood, a lot of, you know, plants that you have just commonly planted around kind of the perimeter of your home. You could also do, if it's, you might find it's really difficult to be able to get even access to the interior of the shrub to cut out that, you know, one third of the thickest canes. So you could consider just coppicing the plant, which means that basically you cut the entire plant down flush with the ground level. And with a plant like a lilac that has been established in that area for a long time, you'll see new growth just shoot right up from there early next spring. You might not get flowers for a year or two, but after that point, you'll be able to kind of manage the growth with the renewal pruning and keep it kind of, you know, just healthy and thinned out in the middle for years to come.
Yeah. And you'll get a lot more, you'll get much more flowering.
Yes, much nicer
much more.
Flowers and flowers down where you can actually see them. And just especially with lilacs, they are one of the, you know, plants I think that most benefits from that renewal pruning.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck, Alyssa. Thank you for calling. Anne in Thorpe, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Anne.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Earlier this summer, we noticed two plants that the birds had brought in, we think, And so we ID'd them on an identity app, and they were told they were nanny berries, which we'd never heard of. So we looked those up, and one site said they're poisonous, and another site said, no, they're premium wild fall fruit. So which one is right?
Oh, interesting. Well, I am going to offer a word of caution here about, you know, eating anything from your yard that you have only found as a part of like a plant identification app, because any of those apps are subject to, you know, there's some error built into that. So
about 25%.
Yeah, and I they're a good resource, but as far as just launching into eating something based on your identification from the app, just putting that out there. If you are able to, you know, actually positively ID that plant as nannyberry, so this is a native species of viburnum. I believe it's viburnum lentago, and they are a fruit with a long history of being eaten by people, both indigenous people, settlers. They get, around this time of year, a small fruit that's about the size of a raisin, and they have kind of a dry sort of pasty texture and a flavor. I think if you get good ones, they taste like dates. So they're very, they do have a little bit of a leathery skin. I am not sure how many, you know, I have cooked and done things with nanny berries before. My most successful thing that I was able to do with a large quantity of them is make a fruit leather. And so because they do have also a really big seed in each of those little drupelets. And so they're a bit of a pain to
yes,
kind of work with. But I did, when I did the fruit leather, I just took a whole bunch of nanny berries. My folks had a bumper crop at their home 1 year, and then soaked them in just a little bit of water, boiled them a little bit on the stove, and then used like a food mill or a colander to extract the pulp. And then that I spread into a thin layer, and I made a fruit leather out of it, which was really awesome. And I have a very high tolerance for doing really labor-intensive stuff in the kitchen. So for me, this was a perfectly normal thing to be doing. Otherwise, they do make a really nice little snack just when you're out in your yard. And they are, again, an incredible wildlife food. So they're going to be, you know, bringing in migratory birds at this time of year. If they hang on through the winter, you know, you might see cardinals and other winter residents like that eating the berries that are out there. So if you don't get to them, somebody
the
else
birds will.
Yep,
for sure. And the nanny berry, the one site that said, oh, they're poisonous, you know, there's different names that are given to plants sometimes that are not the original name, the scientific name.
Yeah, common names are definitely also, you know, to be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt sometimes. So make sure the first step in this process, I think, is, you know, if you have a local extension agent or somebody like that up in your neck of the woods, or even just take a stem with some fruits into like a good garden center near you and make sure you get a positive ID on that plant before you consider eating any of the berries. But nanny berries are awesome. If that's what you have, I would definitely consider you know, harvesting them or at least just eating a few for fun.
Erin Presley, our guest today, horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. And you can join in as well with your questions. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR, and then we will be back. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News.
Thank you.
You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Aaron Presley, horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Always great to have Aaron come by. And certainly if you have a question for her, I hope you'll join in. We've talked herbs, but a whole variety of other things as well relating to the outdoor garden and landscape. Give a call, 800-642-1234. Phone at 1-800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Now let's go to Mark in Scandinavia. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. I wanted to grow blue cohosh, and I planted about 600 seeds last fall. And I'm pretty good at identifying new stuff coming up. I put them in an open woods in lots of different habitats, and so far I've seen nothing that looks remotely like it. Any tips on the trade?
Blue cohosh. First, tell people what that is we're talking about here. Mark, why are you growing it?
It's a native species. It's interesting, and it's not for food. It's poisonous, but it's good, I don't know, variety and habitat. I've got, 400-some species here at the farm, and I'd like more.
Okay. Oh, awesome. Yeah, so blue cohosh, and I'm just going to make sure that we're talking about the same plant here, but is Colophyllum thalictroides. And so it can be a little confusing with some of the native woodland species. A lot of times when we're talking about common names, they have, common names can overlap and get mistaken and stuff. But blue cohosh, the Colophyllum thalictroides. One thing that I would look for is maybe if you take a look, Mark, from your vendor of those seeds, or look for another reputable vendor of native seeds. I always suggest Prairie Moon Nursery in Winona, Minnesota. They have an excellent website. And just double check the germination requirements on the seeds. For most of our native plants, like you're describing, I'm assuming that you did, you just direct sow those seeds. And the stratification that happens over the winter as far as the freezing and thawing and moisture being able to penetrate the seed coat is what allows them to germinate. One thing with some woodland seeds, and I think this can be the case also for the wild American ginseng, like we were mentioning, they actually need to go through like a double dormancy. So sometimes they might need to go through two winters before they're able to germinate.
Oh.
So that might be something that you're encountering there. But once you get, I know in our woodland garden at Olbrich, we have some established colophyllum, and once those suckers get going, they put out a lot of seed and they spread quite a bit, in a good way. So I think once you can even just get, a few individuals going, you'll be able to see them start propagating in your woods without a lot of trouble. Can't hurt to just get a few more seeds this fall and lay them down before the winter and, kind of bolster your chances for next year that way, too.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And a text message from Renee, who's in the Madison area. One question that is exceptionally frustrating for me is that I love lavender, but cannot keep it alive either in a pot or in the garden to save my life.
To save her life.
By the way, she says that you're awesome. She's picking up a lot of tips.
Okay. Well, thank you. I do my best. So for lavender, one thing that is going to be really helpful for you in cultivating lavender is what normally kills it off for us is damp conditions over the winter. It's not so much that the temperatures are too cold. It's that, especially if you have heavy soil, if we have winter freezing and thawing, those wet soil conditions is what really is bad for the health of the lavender. And so if you are growing outside, pick a really, really well-drained area or even amend your planting site with a bunch of gravel, like a sharp-draining gravel. in a pot. That I'm not really sure what to tell you. The one thing is, if you're trying to keep the pot outside over the winter, probably just the roots of the lavender are freezing. You might want to try bringing that pot into your, you know, garage or someplace that where the temperature is modulated a little bit more during the winter. And then definitely pay attention to the varieties. One of the most highly recommended lavenders for our area, which is really reliably hardy, is called Phenomenal. And that plant also has the benefit of being, it's really vigorous and it makes a really large plant. So you have lots of flowers and lots of foliage to work with. So the Phenomenal is one variety that you might want to give a go sometime. And that's pretty easily found at like a good garden center. The Phenomenal lavender is a pretty popular plant in, for Wisconsin growers.
I think somebody is growing that in my neighborhood and it's done really well all summer long.
Yeah, that's a good, has been a good variety for us at Ulbrich.
Phil in Mount Horeb, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Very appropriately suitable to the last caller, I'm interested in wildflowers, two issues. One is the preparation of a seed bed in a large field, a half-acre field. I'd like to extensively propagate wildflowers in this field, and I'm wondering if by dragging a tooth harrow over the field, I can expose enough soil to get the seed to soil firm, and then pat that that broken soil down so that there's contact. I wonder if that's an option, and I also wonder what is the viability of older seeds, seeds that I collected in 22 and 23 and now 24. How much germination am I going to get on seeds in 22 and 23?
You can test that out for yourself, the viability of the seeds, I think, by doing a little test with the wet.
Yeah, you might be able to do a germination test using a lot of times, like for vegetable seeds, you would just take a damp paper towel and then wrap that around a few of the seeds and then put it in a Ziploc bag and then check it periodically, like, you know, check it every day to see if any of those seeds are germinating. With the wildflower seeds, though, that might not work as well because, like we were mentioning before, a lot of those native seeds require a winter stratification period.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not sure whether you're going to be able to tell the viability there.
You're right.
Again, a lot of these questions for the scale that you're talking about, you know, I know a little bit about propagating native seeds and wildflowers on a small scale, but you're going to really want to look for a much more specialized resource than what I can offer you as far as advice. So I would check out, you know, what would be a great book is Neil DeBole. We mentioned this book the last time I was on the show, Larry. What is the name of his book, Gardening with Prairie Plants?
Something close to that.
Yeah.
Neil DeBole is the author, and his actually the place probably to go would be to go, just go to Prairie Nursery, because he will have a lot of tips and information right on the website about growing. And I think you're going to have some trouble, a little bit of trouble with the idea that you have, but maybe not. I'm certainly not the expert. I would definitely go to either the book, which did you find?
So Neil DeBole is a really well-known Wisconsin plants person, and he has a amazing, really a pioneer in native plant propagation and using native plants in gardens. But he has an amazing book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, that just came out in the last year or two. That is a super good resource. And then the website for his company, Prairie Nursery, which is located in Westfield, Wisconsin. Those would be good places to start. I saw Neil talk at a conference that was about a week ago, and he was just also the best speaker. He was just a hoot.
He is.
Yeah, just a great guy, so knowledgeable. And, you know, we're so lucky in Wisconsin that we have all of these amazing plant people that are really have been pioneers and have, you know, formed models that people all over the country and abroad are following now. And Neil is...
He has a worldwide reputation.
And he's right up there with, like, the top planting minds, really, of our day. So, we're, yeah, very fortunate
to have him. So, Phil, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. John in Appleton, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. I just want to add to Phil's question on his starting his prairie plants. If his field is, you know, weedy at all, my own experience is, you know, if you think you really need to, and I think Neil would agree with this, you really have to get rid of the weeds first.
Yeah.
You know, and like ground up or cultivating and 3-4 times a summer for 2 or 3 seasons to really get a good start for these things. But anyway, that's my 2 cents on that. But
yeah, I didn't want to discourage him, but you're right.
Oh, I know. It can be, because you put a lot of work into it, and all of a sudden it's just, you know, goldenrods and all kinds of nasty things that are coming up, and it gets a little discouraging. So, but anyway, my question is about hydrangeas, and I don't know the variety, except that it's like a acorn kind of flower head. It's white. It's in my north side of my house. And it blooms basically August through October. But it really is extremely happy behind my house, grows well, and, you know, too well, to the point where it gets to be very large. So last year I thought, oh, I'm going to really cut this guy back, you know, and kind of see if I can stunt it a little bit and, you know, get it to get back to more manageable size so it's not blocking my windows. But, you know, I did that, and this year the shoots, the new growth that came off of it are like 2.5 feet tall with, you know, big flower heads. And now they're all just about touching the ground, or, you know, because the flower heads are so big and heavy. Is there an appropriate way of managing the, you know, like the growth of these things?
Right. So it sounds like from what you're describing that you probably have hydrangea paniculata. Some cultivar of hydrangea paniculata, which is a woody hydrangea that becomes like a small tree or a large sort of woody shrub. And those are very prunable, which normally you're going to want to be doing in March. It's a little cumbersome to describe on the air, but we have a way at Ulbrich that we prune them to promote fewer but stronger branches and shoots. And so it kind of involves going throughout the whole plant and cutting back any of the growth that is thinner than a pencil at the nodes. And then that promotes the new growth that comes is a little bit sturdier and thicker, and you don't have those floppy stems that are hitting the ground. I would suggest to you, we have a hydrangea pruning class that we run every March. And we're actually looking for next spring at doing a whole series of kind of like beginner to intermediate gardening classes that are available through our education department. So I would take a look at our class catalog when it comes out. And that hydrangea pruning is something that we would cover in several of our upcoming classes, you know, next March or April, because the best way to really learn about something like that is kind of seeing it in person, I think.
Yeah. There you go, John. Thank you so much. Speaking of hydrangeas, Ann wonders, well, she has 2 hydrangea and 2 wagila shrubs that she bought in midsummer and hasn't, she's kept them watered and they look relatively healthy, but she hasn't planted them yet and time is running out. Can she keep them in their pots through the winter?
You know, I think that it does feel a little bit late, but for woody plants, especially deciduous plants like that, you really can plant them up until the ground freezes. And so I would just go ahead and get them in the ground. Make sure that you water really well. And then one thing that's going to be helpful for the success over the winter is give them a nice, good, thick coat of mulch so that they have a little bit of extra insulation. But especially Weigelia or hydrangea, unless you have a real specialty plant, those are pretty hardy in the landscape. And you're going to have better success just relying on Mother Nature and getting those in the ground versus trying to find some, you know, workaround to keep them in their pots over the winter.
Frances in Iron County, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you for having me on your show. I have a new mound septic system, and I need to plant some shallow-rooted species, preferably native species. Right now I have a nurse crop on there, and I was told you know, prairie plants are not good because they're very deep-rooted, and it might impact the septic system. So do you have any suggestions on shallow-rooted, more native plants?
I actually think the deep-rooted are can be beneficial on a mound system. You may want to take a look at the Prairie Nursery website. Because they have plants for mound systems on the website, but that's me just jumping in here.
I think that I was going to say I am not a homeowner, and so I have very little experience with what some of the specs are and things that you're actually looking for characteristics for plants that will commingle happily with whatever's going on within your mound system. So, I would, if there's a list on that Prairie Nursery website.
That would be the recommendation I would have. For sure. And you agree with that.
I think that seems a lot better than anything I'm going to be able to come up with right now. Yeah.
There you go, Frances. Thanks for calling. Now, the Herb Fair is Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And you got some great speakers. It's a free event at the Olbrich Botanical Gardens, and you've got three speakers throughout the day.
Right. So the Madison Herb Society they always do just an amazing job of lining up these people who both have like a wealth of herbal knowledge, but are also really good educators. And so the theme of this year's Herb Fair is cultivating herbal wonder. And it kind of speaks to this idea that by, living with and growing and cooking with herbs, it really kind of taps you into this sense of connectivity, right? It's like you're getting a sense of all of the knowledge and joy that these plants really carry with them and make accessible to us, as well as this, wealth of ancestral knowledge that humans have cultivated and tapped into in using these plants and partnering with them, and really gives you kind of that sense of like connectivity and wonder at being a part of something that is bigger than you are. And so kicking off the first time slot in the morning for the talks at 10:30 is Jane Hawley Stevens, of Four Elements Organic Herbals. She has a wonderful herb farm that's up in Baraboo and just a very well-known local herbalist. And she will be offering a progressive view of traditional gardening by the moon and kind of talking about how in ancient times, people really looked to the skies when they were timing their gardening practices, and ways that we can kind of learn from that and then re-envision how those techniques have applicability in our modern life. Similarly, with kind of that like much wider view beyond just what's going on in your little life or your kitchen, at 12:30, we have Kyle Denton of Tippecanoe Herbs, which is a herbal business that is based in Milwaukee, actually. And so Kyle is going to be offering his talk is called Medicine of the World Tree, a cosmological journey of medicine and myth from the forest floor to the canopy of various cultural central trees. You know, a lot of times when we are thinking of herbs, it's easy to just think of kind of the old standbys that you're growing in your window box. But there's a wealth of herbal trees as well. So we're talking about the witch hazels that are blooming right now, spice bush. There's, you know, sugar maple can even be considered an herbal tree. It's giving us this awesome product of maple syrup. So
sure,
all of these, you know, wonderful wisdom and quality of life improvements that trees around us are offering. And then at 2:30 p.m., we'll have Chef Kevin Appleton on the culinary uses of herbs, practical tips, and creative ideas. And this is going to be a really good talk for just kind of some really good tips and tricks for herbs in the kitchen. But he's going to be covering lots of just, you know, really details, practical tips about using fresh versus dried herbs, different types of chopping techniques. At what point in your dishes do you incorporate your herbs to kind of really get the best flavor profiles of out of a given herb in a particular dish? So just, you know, no matter what time you're arriving at the herb fair tomorrow, should be able to catch one of those speakers. They're at 10:30, 12:30, and 2:30. Check out the vendors and just meet some awesome people that you can talk herbs with.
And it's all free.
And it is 100% free. The herb fair is free to visit, and at Olbrich, admission to the outdoor garden is also free as well.
And maybe I'll make it there in time to get some of that jam.
Gotta get over there.
Oh, I tell you, it's always a pleasure, Erin, to have you with us today.
Oh, I am just always a really great opportunity to hear what your listeners have to say, and glad to share whatever knowledge I can to help people on their own gardening quests.
All right, here's one quick question. Sharon emailed, can you overwinter lavender inside? Because we didn't really address, it doesn't sound like it works well.
You know, you're maybe going to have 50-50% success rate. Give it a go. Put it in a sunny window. One thing with some Mediterranean herbs like lavender is they are adapted in a Mediterranean climate to get a little bit of moisture in the winter. So you could keep it kind of evenly moist, somewhat similar to like your other houseplants. But just, you know, plants are pretty, they're pretty affordable to go to your local independent garden center next year in the spring and get a nice, fresh, sprightly new lavender and just don't sweat it too much.
Yeah. And Jill says that the Mumstead variety works well for her in the Watertown area.
Yes, Munstead and Hidcote are two of the other ones that are good for Wisconsin usually.
Hers is still blooming. She's got photo to prove it. Thank you so much, Erin. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry.
Erin Presley is horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, where she cares for the herb, the wildflower, and the pond gardens. It's great to have her with us. And she always brings me a nice, tasty treat, too, which I love. Coming up, we're going to take a look at bonsai gardening. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention now to the beauty of bonsai. Bonsai is a Japanese art of growing and shaping miniature trees in containers. They're amazing works of art, and we'll talk with him today about, with Kevin, our guest, Kevin Stavikin, who is owner of Wisconsin Bonsai. We'll talk with Kevin about how to grow them, a little about the mystery surrounding the growing of bonsai. It's something we can do, and maybe you have an interest in starting a bonsai. What questions do you have? Have you tried before but didn't have success? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Kevin Staviken, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, and I want to thank you for the correct pronunciation of the last name. I would just like to throw one correction, though. It's Wisco Bonsai, not Wisconsin.
Wisco Bonsai. I should have, Bonsai. I should have known that. I did know it.
No worries. No worries.
Just spoke it. How'd you get interested in bonsai?
I've always had a lot of cool house plants, and I also had a sculpture studio, and I'm going to make this long story very short, but one day a guy walked into our office with one of his tropical bonsai trees to overwinter it in his office, and I just happened to walk by, happened to see it. It blew my mind, and that was all there was to it.
And now we have, and now you own Wisco Bonsai. Tell us about it.
I wanted to have a shop where we folks come and get all your basic supplies for bonsai. Wisconsin has not had a dedicated bonsai shop in a long time. And so I saw the need, and I wanted to fill that little niche.
Well, Kathleen in Madison has a question for us already. Let's just turn there. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, I'm so glad to get to ask a bonsai question. I have 8 little gamble oaks in 2-gallon grow pots, and the gamble oaks actually come from up in the Uinta Mountains, and so they stay really small, and they don't tend to get any bigger than 25 feet, and that's pretty rare. So I saw one of them sticking straight out of a cliff for 6 feet before it turned up towards the sun, and I'm like, I want to do that miniature. So I brought a bunch of those acorns back home, and so I have these little eight guys that have made it since last year, and I'm just wondering the best way to overwinter them so that they, other than protecting them from chipmunks, anything else you could recommend?
Well, sheltered for sure. In a garage or a shed or anywhere like that, they won't need light. Once they drop their leaves, they're all done with photosynthesis for the year. So your main thing is shelter, out of the winds. The winds will really desiccate, your trees if left outside. So I would protect those in, like I said, a garage or a shed. And another real quick note. Now it sounds like you grew those from the acorns, right?
Yes, I did.
Congratulations on that. However, they are going to take a really long time to put any girth on them in a pot. If you wanted to, you could plant those in the ground for a few years, maybe 2 or 3 years, and let them bulk up on the trunk. That's one thing that I would recommend, because they will stay thin and spindly in a grow pot for way longer than they would in the ground.
Oh, you know, that makes some sense.
We can. Yep.
Yeah. Go ahead. Okay. I'm sorry, Kevin.
No, I'm sorry. Can't get a fat trunk on a bonsai, on a short tree, without growing that trunk up first and then chopping it down for deciduous trees like the lake and oak.
Kathleen, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. So what trees typically are used in growing bonsai?
Anything at all, really. The only real eliminating factor of a species would be leaf size. So some of our native trees, like our sugar maples and things like that, they have really, really big leaves, which look ridiculous on a tiny tree. So any tree that will allow us to get the leaf smaller over time through our techniques will make good bonsai. So all your elms, your maples, I'm looking around here, of course, all your evergreens, junipers, pines.
They will all work.
Yeah, any species. There's very few species that do not work.
Can you tell us about the history of, and this is a Japanese art form, is it not?
Well, eventually it was, just as eventually it's a North American art form. It started in China with Penjing, and now there's actually some evidence showing that it probably started in India before even China, because there's depictions from back then of potted trees. So bonsai just means tree in pot or tree in tray. So it likely started in India. Then China got a hold of it, and they did Penjing, which is more landscape-based. Very interesting looking, but usually not a single tree in a pot. It's usually several trees forming more of a landscape. And then Japan got a hold of it, and it became what we now know as bonsai.
Oh. It's very interesting. I think the history of it had something to do with simplicity and minimalism, and they make for a striking addition to any home, for sure.
Yeah, well, that's also kind of one of the misconceptions that folks have, though, is having them in the home. These trees have to be outside, spring, summer, fall. They are not houseplants. They don't do well in the house. Now, of course, some of the tropical ones, we have to bring them in the winter into the house as opposed to cold storage. So there's that to consider.
Yeah, I guess I was just reacting to it. I mean, most of the photos, you look at a photo of bonsai and it's always in the house or, in a building. And so I guess that's why we think that.
Yeah, we'll bring them in for display purposes. And they will survive indoors, but they won't thrive. No. And the bonsai needs to be thriving with all of its pistons firing for us to do any of the work on them that we like to do, whether it be pruning of the foliage, pruning of the roots, bending of the branches with wire, all of that sort of thing. The tree needs to be 100% vibrant, pulsing with energy, something we won't get from indoor growth.
Yeah. Kevin in Oregon has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a Japanese, I think it's a juniper, and I have not overwintered it. I kept it outside in the summer, but I bring it in inside and do the trimming right now. But I'm a little, I guess you answered a little bit about what's the consequence of not wintering the plant. And also I have a ginseng ficus, and I'm wondering, it's doing really well after I repotted it, but is there any overwintering that you do with that variety?
All right, so first of all, the juniper. The juniper, you're wondering how to really overwinter that, right? They understand that?
Yes, and what's the consequence of not doing it?
Right, the consequence. So not letting it ever get a hibernation period or a dormancy period will be just like us not getting sleep. Its health will slowly deteriorate. It'd be fine 1 year, maybe 2 years, skipping a dormancy, but then you will definitely see its health just decline and decline and decline. They really need that time to rest. They've spent all spring, summer, and into the fall developing resources for next year. And they're holding on to those resources, and they need to rest during the winter time so that they can then continue their physiological cycle next year with using those resources that they were storing up and then going into the end cycle at the end of the year again to go back into dormancy. So it's just like us with sleep. All right.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as the ginseng ficus, just that I would not let it get below 45 or 50 outside overnight lows, and then bring it in for the season.
Kevin, does that help?
Yes, it does. I just don't want to have any long-term damage by not caring correctly. So this is helpful.
Yeah,
Thank you.
And you're in Oregon, so your climate is much different than ours. Your tree might, depending on where in Oregon you are, might be fine just outside without being necessarily sheltered. I don't think you, depending on where you are, you don't get 20 below zero, do you?
No, Oregon, Wisconsin. So
Oregon, Wisconsin.
I thought, oh man, someone's calling all the way from Oregon. okay, never mind. So yeah, you do get 20 below. So yes, I would definitely shelter that in a garage or a shed or something like that. So if you can give it a little light, like with a garage window, that would be fine. But if it doesn't get any light, that's okay too. Conifers, they'll use a little light over the winter if they can get it. But like I said, it's not critical.
Kevin, there you go. Thanks for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Talking bonsai right now with Kevin Staviken, owner of Wisco Bonsai. Thanks for listening in. And I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Coming up on Monday on the program, we'll be talking about our state's historical markers, and we'll also be catching up on news from the Driftless region. Right now, we're talking about bonsai with our guest, Kevin Staviken, who is owner of Wisco Bonsai. Great to have him with us. And callers online, you can join in, by the way. It's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Janice in Antioch, Illinois. Thank you for joining in. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to let you know a comment. I lived in Japan between 65 and 67, and one of my students took us to see the emperor's bonsai trees, and some of them were like 400 years old. So how do you keep them that long? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I thank you very much, Janice, for calling. And 400 years old, and these trees can these bonsais can live a long time.
Yeah, and the way that we keep them living as long as we do is we never let them reach a point of stasis like they do in nature. In nature, a tree will grow, and it'll reach its maximum potential and have nothing further to do, at which point it starts to decline and die. With bonsai, we are constantly giving the tree something new to do and not allowing it to reach its point of stasis or natural maxed out growth. So every year or two, not every year, every couple few years, we're pruning the roots. Well, now that foliage has a job to do by growing new roots. When we prune the top, the roots have a job to do, grow a new top. So by constantly giving the tree a job to do, it has a reason to keep living. And so there are some that have been in pots for well over 400 years. We have no idea how long that we can keep a tree alive in a pot.
Yeah.
It could be the human concept of forever. We just don't know.
Janice, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. So it's either trimming the branches or the roots.
Yeah, that's just
keep it working.
It a job to do. Yep, keep it working. Keep giving it a job to do. Give it a reason to live.
Janice, thanks again. Christopher in Green Bay, thank you for calling.
Rosemary plant as a source. I know the Ulbrecht Gardens display at the Garden Expo has a rosemary plant that's been shaped for many years, I think 10 years old at least. Any suggestions on working with that?
Can you work with woody plants like rosemary?
Absolutely. I had a killer rosemary that I unfortunately lost last year by trying to give it a little bit different dormancy, a little bit harder dormancy than it liked. And so I eventually lost that one. But I had a rosemary for going on 8-9 years, and that was a heartbreaker to lose, and I lost it because of my own stupidity. But yeah, so don't overwinter them in a garage, even if you do keep it above freezing. They want to come inside.
over the winter. Yeah.
They want to come inside, Christopher. Thank you very much for calling. Joe in Durand, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for connecting me to this guy. I have a question about bonsai. I have a black walnut that's about 4 inches in diameter, and the form of it I really like. And I'm wondering if there's a limit on sizes that you can air prune to create a bonsai.
Oh, you're talking about air layering it off of an existing tree. You've got a 4-inch limb that you want to take off of an existing tree?
Yes, sir. And I look at it, and it just looks like it's an amazing bonsai waiting to happen.
Yeah. So I've not really heard of a diameter limit on taking an air layer off of a tree. 4 inches sounds super doable. If you look at Graham Potter's videos on YouTube, he's in England. He's air layering stuff 10, 12 inches across.
And what was his name again?
Graham Potter.
Graham Potter. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, as far as timing goes on that, you know, once the leaves harden off in the spring, you're good to go. Throw that air layer on, and then three months later or so, you should have a packet full of roots.
Ah. Joe, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. I like, I guess when you see a bonsai, it's never at least I've never noticed one to be just sort of straight up and down. They're always curved in one fashion or another, and that's part of it, isn't it? And how do you get those curves and looks?
Well, part of it, the desire for that kind of a look is to show a tree that has struggled and persevered and things like that. And that's done with wiring a trunk, wrapping wire around it, and bending it when it's young. And then it'll hold that shape throughout the rest of its life. But we do have actually quite a number, but there is a very effective, just formal upright style that is a very straight tree. And those can be so beautifully elegant as opposed to the ones that are bent and look like they've gone through hell and back during their life. The very straight tall ones offer their own elegance and image of perseverance, like a big, tall, straight tree in the middle of a farm field. Those can be just as fetching as some tortured thing hanging off a cliff.
What are your thoughts?
It's all in the eye.
So what are your thoughts on kits?
On what kits?
On kits, K-I-T-S.
Kits. Don't bother. Don't bother with any bonsai kit. If someone wants to start out, I mean, if you're a little kid, you can grow a seed. Matter of fact, one of my trees that I do have is a guy sent away to the back of either Playboy or Rolling Stone or some magazine back in 1984, roll a bonsai tree, and he got this tiny little stick in the mail. And here it is. And I've got that tree now. Now it's massive and it's big. But if you're going to send away for a kit, you're going to get a little tiny seed. It's going to take forever for that seed to grow. You're better off just go to your local garden center, grab a juniper, and go at it with that. You're way better off because you've already got the trunk grown. You've got all that foliage to work with. You're not twiddling your thumbs for 5 years just watching a tree try to grow.
Okay.
Because people who want to get into bonsai, mostly they don't want to sit and do nothing and just watch something grow. They want to do things.
Yeah.
So that's why I suggest going to the garden center and getting yourself a nice little juniper to go at.
Somebody else emailed on containers. What advice do you have for selecting containers?
Oh, boy. that's a really broad question. Really broad question. You know, some simple guidelines are unglazed for conifers is very popular. Glazed for deciduous trees, like you can put like a nice maple in a blue pot. That always looks nice. But other than that, you know, it's all depends on the tree. It's so individual to each tree, which is why as bonsai practitioners we have 2 to 3 times as many trees, as many pots as we do trees.
Kevin, what service do you provide through Wisco Bonsai?
Oh, well, besides carrying everything that people need for bonsai, I also offer classes one-on-one. I offer group classes. I have workshops. This year I had a big open house with live music and everything else. And so I try to make things fun for people that come here, because if it's not fun, why do it? So I'm not a stodgy practitioner. I'm probably one of the more irreverent bonsai practitioners out there.
Go ahead.
I would say I like rules only so I can bend them. Things like that. Yeah.
And you're located in Sussex.
Yeah, I am. Yep. Waukesha County.
Waukesha County. So you're near some pretty heavy population areas for sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And if anyone would ever like to know what I've got going on, I don't do it on my website or anything like that. My website is woefully out of date. But if anyone wants to send an email to wiscobonsai@gmail.com, I'll add you to the mailing list, and you'll be the first to know when I'm offering classes, workshops, whatever.
All right. That's good to repeat that once again.
Wisco Bonsai, wiscobonsai@gmail.com. Just, you can say, hey, throw me on your mail list and I'll do it.
All right. And we'll post that up on our page, Larry Mueller Show page.
Cool.
So that people can, if they didn't get it written down, they can go to today's date. And we'll have that in the comments section of the show. Perry in Oconto, what's on your mind?
A quick question. I have a Norfolk pine that some of the needles or whatever on the very ends are kind of dying off. Should I trim those, leave them? And then does it need to be like a clay pot for that or not?
Hmm.
Well, those Norfolk pines, I'm not real familiar with them, but if I don't think they like a heavy dormancy, they wouldn't survive outdoors in Wisconsin. So my initial thought would be, yes, that would need to come inside for the winter. And I see other people with Norfolk pines in their house 365 days a year, and they do just fine. So that's where I would go with that. Bring them in the winter. What was the other part of your question?
Perry, what was your? Did you have another part to your question?
Yeah, do I trim those dying needles? The ends or not?
So you say the dying needles are at the tips or at inside on the branches?
At the tips of the branches.
Oh, huh. I would say that you could probably trim those back. You might want to, having browning at the tips is a little maybe concerning, nothing I could diagnose over the phone, but typically at this time of year, your pines will be losing their third year needles, meaning the older needles further in on the branch. The new ones at the tip of the branch shouldn't really be browning. So that could be a water issue, maybe not enough water. I'm not going to say sunlight. Again, without seeing it, it's really hard to guess on that. It may be as simple as just a little bit not enough water, or a little bit too dry of air.
Oh, okay. Perry.
Norfolk Island, I'm quite sure, is pretty misty. Pretty damp.
Thank you so much, Perry, for that question. And Kevin Staviken, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I appreciate that. Time flew by, and hopefully we can do this again. Thank you.
Oh, I'd be glad to do it again. This was fun.
Kevin Staviken, owner of Wisco Bonsai, our guest today. It was great to have him with us, and we can talk about it again. Lots of interest there, and it was fun talking with him. Always fun meeting together with my gang of people here for our show, producers Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn, and, of course, our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. And again, thanks for listening. Have a great weekend and stay with us. Lots in store here on WPR News.